Hello and welcome to No Character Limit. My name is Robert Thurk, and today you're going to hear episode 23 of my book entitled Ultima Thule: Unraveling the Unknown. This is going to be the second half of chapter 14 called Cosmic Real Estate. And while in most episodes I feel like they can stand alone pretty well, in this episode I definitely advise that you at least listen to the last episode where I introduce some of the more highly reported on meteorite hunters and sellers, such as Mike Farmer, Robert Ward, Daryl Pitt, and Robert Hagg. Because in this episode, I'm going to continue talking about some other stories that they're associated with, as well as introduce new stories related to ownership and the financial value of meteorites. In this episode, I also bring back Ernst Chladni from the last chapter, who is, if you forgot, the father of meteoritics, for writing a book theorizing that meteors came from the sky around the turn of the 19th century. And this episode's also pretty special because there is a great example here of a positive, unintended consequence of missions like the 1760s transit of Venus, which I discussed in Chapter 5. So I'm excited to share that with you as well. And I also do a little throwback to Chapter 3 and mention Aloysius Lilius. But for the most part, I just want to get into and finish sharing some of these really interesting stories about valuable meteorites. If you've been enjoying this series, please consider a donation. With each donation, you get a free PDF copy of the book, which has a lot of pictures and descriptions that I just am not able to get in podcast form. You can also like, rate, review, or tell a friend to help spread the word. And you can follow me on social media at NoCharacterLimit at Mastodon.world. And finally, you can reach out to me at NoCharacterLimit at ProtonMail.com. So after we finish today's episode, there are only two more chapters left to go. So please enjoy the rest of Chapter 14, Cosmic Real Estate. Chapter 14, Part 5, The Prized Achondrite. Palisades. Mike Farmer had always been fascinated with meteorite collecting, but it was not very lucrative for him at first. Meteorite hunting can be feast or famine, and even his wife began to doubt her husband's dedication to the hunt. Then he went to Morocco, and it changed his life. There, he acquired a moon rock, which he was able to sell for enough money to have Farmer's wife never doubt him again. In 2009, he made another precious discovery of a 117-pound meteorite on a farm in Springwater, Canada, which likely goes down as Farmer's most famous find. It was the latest piece in a series of Springwater discoveries that go back to 1931, when the first piece of the Springwater meteorite was found, weighing 41 pounds. The Springwater meteorite belongs to the priciest class of meteorites known as palisites, the value of which rivals the price of meteorites from the Moon or Mars. Palisites are technically achondrites, like pieces from Mars or the Moon are, but rather than being from the surface of a massive body, they had sunk well below the crust of their planet, melding into iron when some catastrophic collision occurred, and the ancient planet was torn wide open, flinging its insides out and freezing the whole melting process. The core of these destroyed planets broke into pieces of iron meteors that were cooled. The surface of these destroyed planets created stony achondrite meteors like the Allen Hills meteorite. But palisites are one of those rare transitional types of meteorites called stony iron, because they weren't quite at the core of their dead planet, but they definitely were not at the surface either. Palisites come hand-delivered from the heavens with a beauty all of their own, hidden just beneath its scorched surface. A beautiful blend of iron mixed with large, translucent, amber olivine crystals, a form of semi-precious stone. Palisites can't be mistaken for anything other than a meteorite once you break it open and look inside. Palisites just have an unmistakable look to them that is clearly out of this world. In 1749, one strange iron boulder stood out enough in the mountains of central Siberia that it became a legend for the local tribe of Tartars living there. One curious Cossack who had heard of this mysterious boulder by the natives was known as Yakov Medvedev, and he went to see this Siberian iron. Being a blacksmith, Medvedev found it interesting enough to report it to the local Russian overseer of mines in the Krasnoyarsk province. The overseer, a man by the name of Johann Medek, also found the boulder to be noteworthy and wrote up a report which he likely sent out to various officials. But it was there that the interest ended, and the rock remained hidden by the endless taiga, as no one came to follow up on it. With no further action taken by the government, Medvedev decided that he would take the unusual boulder and did the exact same thing that the neighbor of the Oregon Steel and Iron Company did with the Willamette meteorite and moved it 20 grueling miles to his house. And just like the Willamette meteorite, it became a widely talked about oddity that reached the town of Krasnoyarsk about 150 miles away. One soldier that heard the rumors about the golden blacksmith stone went to check it out and knocked off a piece to bring it back to the famous naturalist from St. Petersburg that was staying in the city, Peter Simon Pallas. Peter Simon Pallas was not a Russian himself. He was the son of one of the best surgeons in Prussia. But Peter would go on to eclipse his father's feats as a Prussian naturalist. Pallas first became a doctor by the age of 19 and was elected to become a member of the Royal Society by the age of only 23. Before Darwin's theory of evolution, Pallas had already begun classifying organisms in a family tree manner, which only grew in popularity after Darwin's theory came around. He was so well known that Catherine the Great invited him to teach in St. Petersburg, and ultimately to participate in the 1769 Transit of Venus expedition as a naturalist. While in St. Petersburg, he was called upon Catherine the Great to be consulted while she endeavored in finding a hidden language at the root of all languages. Pallas then found himself in Siberia as a result of the 1769 Transit of Venus, when Catherine the Great was sending a variety of scientists into the realm's vast taiga for observations of the heavens and earth. It was during this journey when the soldier dropped the chunk of iron from Medvedev's roadside boulder onto Pallas's desk. Medic, the overseer of mines, apparently had sent a report to Pallas about the rock around the same time as the soldier was visiting Krasnoyarsk, but Pallas either did not receive this report or did not read it. It was the sample that struck Pallas's attention. Pallas knew at once that it was a natural iron, a rare natural metal that had been found mysteriously sitting in random places around the earth with no known cause. As this was decades before Chladni came up with his theory on meteorites, the connection between natural irons and the sky had not yet been made. Pallas learned that this boulder was so large that it could provide countless samples for study that could help unravel their mysterious origin. At some point in the process, Pallas also questioned Medvedev, who shared with Pallas his thoughts of the rock. Medvedev stated, quote, "The amazing whiteness and malleability of the boulder, and its ringing tone when hammered, allowed me to think that the boulder might be of a material more noble than iron. The Tartars, who thought the boulder a holy stone fallen from heaven, have confirmed me in this opinion." End quote. A holy stone fallen from heaven? Unlikely words from the superstitious Tartars, but Pallas decided they were worth recording nonetheless. Pallas had studied countless rocks and knew none of them were capable of flying, and was likely quick to dismiss the notion that it fell from the sky. Pallas decided that this unusual boulder needed to be transported to St. Petersburg, which happened to be about 3,000 miles away. The entire journey to the capital took an agonizing 4 years, as it could only travel by sled in the winter until it hit the next big river, where it would wait around for summer to be ferried across. Once safely on the other side, the overseers would once again wait for winter to return to make it across the next stretch of land over to the next river. Once it reached Krasnoyarsk, it was shipped out of Siberia on the Yenisei River to St. Petersburg, which was the longest stretch of the journey, but also took the least amount of time. Once it reached St. Petersburg, samples of the unusual rock were knocked off and shipped across Europe for examination. Pallas, recognizing the iron in the rock, wrote a paper surmising that its origin was from some unknown geological process of the earth. The rock caused such an interest that pieces of the rock began being called Pallas iron, which ultimately would be where the word Pallasite is derived. And this is the magic of a Pallasite. A rock in the middle of Siberia gets enough attention to not only be dragged 20 miles to the nearest town, but also 3,000 miles to the capital over some of the most difficult terrains on the planet, where pieces of it are then chipped off and sent around the world to be inspected more closely. A rock that can capture this sort of attention should only begin to give an idea of how alluring a Pallasite can be. Pallas's famed iron even caught the attention of Ernst Chladni, as he was developing his meteorite origin theory. In 1794, the same year that Chladni wrote his watershed book claiming that meteorites came from the sky, Chladni visited St. Petersburg to play his newly invented musical instrument, the euphone, for the Empress Catherine the Great. The euphone is an ethereal instrument consisting of glass rods that vibrate at surreal pitches and sounding somewhat like the modern-day electronic synthesizer. It's definitely worth looking up and listening to it just to get an idea of this rare instrument. This means that Chladni would have been in the same city as Pallas and the unusual iron rock that would become central to his book. While it doesn't appear clear whether he traveled to St. Petersburg or published the book first, the euphone was the perfect instrument to evoke the eerie and beautiful feelings one gets when contemplating outer space. Imagining Chladni playing the euphone in a room with Catherine the Great, Peter Simon Pallas, and the baffling anomaly of the Pallas iron somewhere nearby is ripe for a Hollywood movie. The idea of the two great intellectual minds of Chladni and Pallas, both world-renowned scientists in their own discipline, with differing views on the famed iron, in the same room together with Catherine the Great, seems almost too good to be true. But alas, to this day, it is not known if Chladni took the time to visit the strange Pallas iron, or if he discussed it with Pallas at all. If Chladni did not take the time to view the unusual specimen in person, it would be a shock, as Pallas's iron became the featured meteorite of his book, succinctly titled On the Origin of the Iron Masses Found by Pallas and Others Similar to It, and on some associated natural phenomena. Thus, it was a Pallasite that brought Chladni to propose the theory that rocks fall from the sky to begin with, something the entire scientific community believed to be preposterous at the time, including by Peter Simon Pallas himself. Chladni noticed that the Pallas iron had a lot of similarities to other natural irons that were found around the world and baffled scientists. And if he did not visit the main mass, he may have been able to observe one of the pieces that Pallas chipped off and sent around the world. At the end of the 18th century, the only known way to produce iron was to smelt iron ore, which was made from a rock that looked nothing like natural irons. Even after iron ore was smelted, man-made iron was brittle and nowhere near as malleable or unique as these natural irons. There was no scientific doubt that these natural irons were molten at some point, and yet no volcanoes anywhere on the planet ever produced them. Even more, there were no geological similarities between the places where each of these natural irons were found. Despite their name, they seemed anything but natural. Literally, just as if they really did drop from the sky. Ancient volcanoes, lost advanced civilizations, and lightning strikes were all put forth as reasonable explanations for these inexplicable natural metals. But none of these wild theories had any proof. Chladni couldn't shake the notion about what the local Tartar tribe had said about it coming from heaven. Even as Pallas dismissed it, Chladni put forth that the locals had to be right. The traditional explanations just did not fit the situation. The Pallas iron was too far from any volcanic activity and found near the top of a mountain in a location so remote and difficult to reach that no known ancient civilization could have dwelled there. The heat generated by lightning or forest fires was just too weak to melt a rock to such an extent to create malleable iron. For iron to become malleable, more heat was needed than a mere forge, more heat than anything that could be created on Earth. Chladni proposed that its fiery descent to Earth may have been able to produce the heat necessary to mold it into iron. It was even Chladni who named the glassy yellow component found in Pallasites as olivine. Pallas's iron forced the entire scientific community to see these same massive metals that were guaranteed to plunge to the bottom of the ocean as simultaneously floating, menacingly unseen, above in the sky. Eventually, the Pallas iron was proven to be a meteorite in 1804 by the English mineralogist William Thomson. Despite his useful contribution, Thomson had the misfortune of being named with exactly the same name as one of the greatest scientists of the 19th century, better known as Lord Kelvin, but who would not be born for another 20 years after the mineralogist's discovery of the Pallas iron being a meteorite. Thompson's other misfortune was that he would not receive credit for the discovery that was rightfully his due to his own obscurity. Thompson discovered the Windmanstätten patterns using the Pallas iron a full 4 years before Count Windmanstätten did. For centuries, it went unnoticed until an obscure 1804 journal from Thompson revealed that he had used nitric acid to discover the hidden patterns in the Pallas iron. The Windmanstätten patterns only appear in meteorites, which is one way a lump of iron can be determined to be of extraterrestrial origin. Without Thompson's journal, Windmanstätten was thought of as the person who discovered the process of revealing these unique patterns. Compounded by the eclipse of a scientific legend with the same name and dying early, Thompson has nearly been forgotten by history. The Wikipedia article for Thompson is sparse and full of requests for citations, but someone posted in there that several authors think that the Windmanstätten pattern name should be changed to Thompson Structures in honor of the original discoverer. The Wikipedia article on Windmanstätten patterns even has Thompson Structures as their alternative name. As for what happened to Pallas himself, he would eventually return back to his homeland of Prussia a year before his death in 1810. Forever after, Pallas's name would be associated with the most rare and valuable meteorites found on Earth. For any normal person, this would have been achievement enough. But in addition, Pallas has multiple birds, mammals, and plants named after him, as well as a volcano, a mountain, a peninsula, a town, and several streets. A monument was raised in his honor by Russia, as well as at the site of the Krasnoyarsk meteorite fall in Siberia. Like Chladni, Pallas's impact on the understanding of meteorites was critical and yet accidental, as neither primarily studied the sky phenomena. And the Pallas iron, the meteorite that inspired the whole scientific discipline of meteoritics, currently resides exactly where Pallas had left it over 200 years ago, the Fersman Mineralogical Museum in St. Petersburg. The historic artifact has never been priced, and pieces of it are not likely to be found on the meteorite market, too historically valuable to be so easily accessible. The fact that the main body had never been sold should be an indicator of the value of the Pallasite of Pallasites. Mike Farmer sold his Springwater Pallasite for $610,000 to the Royal Ontario Museum after years of effort rediscovering the landing site of this stony iron beauty that was first found in 1931. In 2006, a farmer in Missouri found a 38-pound Pallasite on a hillside in Conception Junction, which was subsequently valued at $850,000. a highly polished 2-inch sphere of the Semshin Palisite sold for $128,000, about 10 times its original estimated value. Robert Haig purchased the famous Esquil Palisite in 1992, known for being one of the few meteorites impervious to rust and one of the most beautiful. A 2-pound slice of Esquil sold on Christie's for $25,000 in 2018. One palisite, Japara, has peridot gems inside, making them the rarest gem on Earth because they were not forged on Earth. A single 0.2-inch piece sold for $4,000. The 20,000-pound Brenham Palisite, which landed in Kansas so long ago that pieces were found at a Hopewell Indian burial site almost 1,000 miles away in Ohio, proved that even ancient people were drawn to these unique achondrites. The value of a Palisite meteorite transcends both cultures and time. As the supermodels of the meteoritic world, each palisite commands attention in its own unique way. Chapter 14, Part 6, Meteorite Collections. There is one palisite that stands as a paragon of beauty from the cosmos, and that is Fukang. In 2000, a hiker in the Gobi Desert of China came upon a 2,000-pound meteorite, and from there, its value became quickly apparent. When cut open, the Fukang Palisite contained large, glassy, clear chunks of yellowish-green olivine that were so fine they were classified as peridot, just like the Japara Palisite. The variety of colors and the large clusters of the olivine webbed in almost equal amounts of meteoritic iron, made Fukang an ideal sample of cosmic beauty. Most of the Fukang meteorite can be found in the Southwest Meteorite Laboratory, run by business owner and curator Marvin Kilgore. Kilgore ranks right up there with some of the most prominent meteorite hunters in the world today, holding one of the largest private collections on Earth. Housed at the University of Arizona, the Southwest Meteorite Laboratory holds every kind of meteorite imaginable in all sizes, with price tags that soar well into the millions. Often pictured wearing a large cowboy hat, Kilgore has a store that offers up some of the world's most famous meteorites for every price. They have a variety of the local Canyon Diablo meteorite, including small fragments to be used for making jewelry with. They have 1-pound fragments of Argentina's Campo del Cielo for several hundred dollars, and a rare 2-ounce slice of Milbilili, the achondrite from the asteroid Vesta, going for $1,900. They have several smaller shapes and sizes of the Gibeon iron, which is pretty standard fare found on most exchanges, But then they also sell a large 64-pound fragment of Gibeon as well for $75,000. There is also a split moon meteorite, totaling less than a pound, selling for $120,000. But the stars of the Southwest Meteorite Lab are pieces of the Fukang Palisite. One 3-ounce specimen is on sale for $2,550, or about $30 per gram. The most expensive piece for sale in the entire lab is a 23-pound slice of Fukang, and it's priced at $500,000, or about $47 per gram. The Southwest Meteorite Laboratory also holds the largest piece of Fukang in the world, its main mass, which weighs about 925 pounds. In 2008, Kilgore put up the main mass of Fukang for auction for its anonymous owner as the featured item of a Bonhams auction with an asking price of over $2 million. At the time, it would have been sold as the most expensive meteorite in the world, but the main mass didn't end up selling. So it currently remains as the main attraction in the private showroom of Kilgore's Meteorite Lab. The only other meteorite that was put up on auction at a comparable price is the fifth largest moon rock on Earth, a rocky achondrite found in Northwest Africa. Pound for pound, the moon rock is actually more expensive than Fukang, since Christie's put up the 30-pound rock for $2.5 million. But like the main mass of Fukang, the moon rock did not sell for its going price, although a much smaller 1.5-inch sphere of Fukang did sell for $35,000. While any single meteorite may command high prices, the total value of any single collection of meteorites can soar much higher. Naturally, museums have some of the largest collections of meteorites in the world, with the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History leading the way, with over 45,000 specimens of more than 16,850 distinct meteorites, according to their website. And that includes 9 of the roughly 50 total known Martian meteorites on Earth. The National Institute of Polar Research in Japan claims to have nearly 17,000 specimens and one of the largest collections of Antarctic meteorites. Collections like these are near impossible to calculate a financial value for because of how unique all of the meteorites are. There are also large private collections of high value as well, thanks to the private meteorite market. One of the most well-known is the Vatican Observatory meteorite collection, with a more modest 1,100 specimens from over 500 different meteorites. In stark contrast to the closed-minded days of Lilius, Jesuit scientists like Brother Guy collect meteorites to, quote, study creation so that we may come to know more deeply the heart of the Creator, end quote. The Vatican collection has been used for over a century in furthering meteoritic science, They've played important roles in spectroscopy research used to identify some meteorites' asteroids of origins. One of the observatory's most famous pieces is the Nakhla Mars meteorite, which was discovered in 1911 in Egypt. Nakhla was made even more valuable than the typical coveted Martian meteorite because it had been since handled by a variety of popes. And just like with the Allen Hills meteorite, there is speculative evidence of signs of life in the shape of minuscule pits that only occur on terrestrial rocks from microbial life on Earth. Despite this, no definitive conclusions can be made. The Vatican Observatory traces its origins to an observational tower that was built in 1578 under the reign of Pope Gregory XIII, which, according to its website, was in preparation for reforming the Western calendar. The embracing of astronomy and science by the Vatican can trace its roots directly to the time of Aloysius Lilius's achievements. Daryl Pitt's previously discussed Makovic collection was once touted to be the world's most expensive private collection, and it may still be. But today, the Makovic collection has competitors, such as Indian-American billionaire Naveen Jain's personal collection. Jain, who currently lives in the same neighborhood as Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, made his fortune after leaving Microsoft in the 1990s and starting InfoSpace, which became one of the central websites caught up in the dot-com bubble in the late 90s, and was worth billions of dollars before it crashed. By that point, Jain had already cashed out and went on to become a billionaire and, along the way, became a meteorite collector. Jain's first purchase was a $3,000 Campo del Cielo piece from Argentina, a chunk of Hag's White Whale, and has since grown his collection to incorporate over 700 meteorites worth approximately $8.5 million as of 2013. Like the Vatican, Jain also acquired a ping pong ball-sized piece of the Nakhla Martian meteorite for $108,000. He boasts a slice of a rare metallic carbonaceous chondrite known as guba, a piece of Murchison, a couple of slices of one of Fukang's rivals, the Esquel palisite, and some moon achondrites. Jain says about his collection, quote, "These are things that bring us closer to space. This is the only way to feel with your own hands that the moon, that Mars, that outer space is real." End quote. Jain has helped start another business called Moon Express, which wants to send robotic landers to the moon in order to mine it. Chapter 14, Part 7, Mysterious Meteorites, Carrancas. Steve Jurvetson, board member for SpaceX and Tesla, uses meteorite hunters like Mike Farmer to help boost his collection. He has acquired meteorites of Mars and the Moon to add to his large assemblage of memorabilia and equipment used during the famed Apollo missions. This has helped Farmer's meteorite business a lot. In a video featuring primarily his Apollo mission items, Jurvetson allows others in the room to hold one of the largest pieces of Mars and the Moon in private hands from his collection, something Farmer may have been involved in helping him acquire. In 2017, Farmer said, quote, "The Silicon Valley guys have been pretty good the last couple of years. They buy a bit different than the Chinese. The Chinese want large things to put in office lobbies and things like that, whereas the tech guys want rare things, very, very special things." End quote. The role of intermediaries like Mike Farmer, Robert Ward, Daryl Pitt, and Robert Haag can easily be caricaturized looking through only one lens. On one hand, they can be easily seen as capitalistic hucksters flipping mere rocks for an outsized profit. And on the other hand, they can be perceived as treasure hunters of sacred gifts from the heavens, each one a precious, one-of-a-kind fragment of the cosmos. However, the reality of this unusual profession is more complex and has more depth than either of these two perspectives. Meteorites are precious and unique for their unusual origin, scientific value, and ability to serve as an existential reminder that our Earth is very far from being the center of everything. But there is also a bit of magic and mystique that is purposefully imbued into the rocks because human perception is key for bringing in tens or even hundreds of thousands of more dollars for the seller. It is not a mistake that Daryl Pitt intentionally relates his large piece of gibbon to the renowned masterpiece, The Scream, or why a piece of meteorite that crashed into a home or some other man-made object sells for more. In 2018, Epic Magazine wrote an in-depth article on meteorite hunting entitled Landfall, featuring Farmer, Ward, and even a little bit of Haag. A link to it is in the source section, and if you have the time, I definitely recommend reading it because it is a very well-done article. The article claims that a biology professor from McPherson College was one of the first professional meteorite hunters, even well before Haag. Harvey H. Nininger read about meteorites in a 1923 article of the Scientific Monthly and quit his job as a teacher to hunt for meteorites around the world with his wife. Their journeys sounded exotic and romantic as they crossed continents in search of fallen pieces of the heavens. Nininger would then write books that generated a lot of popular attention, one of which even inspired Farmer's frenemy, Robert Ward, to get into meteorite hunting on his desert ranch in Arizona. Nininger and his wife Addie had traveled the world, found thousands of meteorites, and were invited to lecture on their importance. Nininger approached the Smithsonian Museum and offered up their entire collection for an exclusive price, but the Smithsonian declined to purchase the fruits of their labor from them. even worse for Harvey and Addie is that the couple were in serious debt from becoming financially dependent on meteorites that nothing short of divine intervention was going to save them. And that was when Ann Hodges of Sylacauga, Alabama, was hit with her meteorite in 1954. And suddenly, meteorites were a global sensation. Nininger seized the opportunity and sold part of his collection to the British Museum for $140,000, which resulted in a bidding war for the remainder of the now suddenly precious Nininger collection. And the moment where Epic Magazine's article claims that meteorite hunting suddenly became a business. It was a young Robert Ward that was struck by the romance of the Nininger stories and was inspired to purchase a piece of Canyon Diablo, which jump-started a career in meteorite hunting. Nininger actively promoted the nationalization of Meteor Crater and is likely why Ward chose a piece of Canyon Diablo as his first. But the life of meteorite hunting clearly isn't all romance and glory. Most people would consider meteorite hunting an insane and unreliable form of income. Epic Magazine's article really took the time to provide a deep look into the life of meteorite hunters by using the 2007 Carrancas meteorite impact as the central event of the article. While Robert Ward and Mike Farmer were in Spain searching for achondrites, they heard about the Carrancas impact event. The news first reported it as some kind of mysterious explosion or eruption somewhere on the high plains of Peru, a remote Tibet on the South American continent. Farmer and Ward had to decide whether they should stay in Spain and continue the hunt for this particular achondrite, or go and check out the strange Carrancas meteorite that was making international news. It was no secret that meteorites that had witnessed strikes and made the news were good money, if you can get a hold of them first. This was nowhere more apparent than in 2013 when a small meteor exploded over Chelyabinsk, Russia. There are YouTube compilations of the bright fireball lighting up the twilight sky as it streaked towards the surface and delivering a deafening sonic boom. The meteor's entrance into the atmosphere was so powerful that it destroyed property and hospitalized about 1,500 people. Naturally, such a strike made the news, and people began looking for a piece of the largest meteorite to hit the Earth in over a century. It had rained rocks all above the region that children were even finding them in snowbanks. The main mass of Chelyabinsk was found at the bottom of a lake, weighing nearly 1,500 pounds. Pieces of the meteorite quickly found its way online through the usual vendors and can still be purchased for about $20 per gram. One 7-ounce specimen of Chelyabinsk sold for over $15,000 on Christie's. These were the sort of prices that Farmer and Ward had in mind when they suddenly had to consider a trip to the high plateaus of Peru. They faced the dilemma of having one in the hand and two in the bush, that bush being on the other side of the world in an incredibly remote location. At first, the pair didn't even know if the reports were real, but as videos of the crater left behind and pictures of pieces found from the crash began to emerge, they realized that Carrancas was legit. What suddenly made Carrancas even more enticing was that the pieces being shown from the fall came from a chondrite. Being that chondrites are stony, it was widely believed most wouldn't be able to stay intact long enough to make a crater when they reached the ground. This is exactly what happened to the chondritic Chelyabinsk, its breakup being the cause of so much damage in the city. Yet, there was a chondrite in a hole on the high plateaus of Peru, just waiting to prove science wrong. This meteorite could be worth big money if they could get to it, and if they could get to it first. Competition in meteorite hunting is tight. Farmer and Ward were already in competition with Robert Hagg at their Spanish hunting grounds, and they knew he would have heard of the Carrancas fall too. Ward and Farmer are not exactly full partners in this endeavor either. One time, Ward thought Farmer was having him trailed, only to find out that it was another meteorite hunter altogether. Not that Ward trusted any of Farmer's denials when he confronted him about it. Meteorite hunters come from all parts of the world, each one as unique and invested in the hunt as Farmer, Ward, and Hagg. Although meteorite hunting is worldwide, it's also a small community too. Farmer bought his first meteorite from Hagg, and Hagg had even helped Farmer better understand meteorites. Then, suddenly, Farmer became a competitor to Hagg in the business, and their relationship deteriorated. By 2007, Farmer had gone in debt like Nininger when he found his $79,000 lunar meteorite, and things began to turn around for him, ultimately selling his $610,000 springwater palisade that he found in Canada. The issue of trust between meteorite hunters has been hard to bridge. But Farmer and Ward are occasionally able to work together and rely on each other when in difficult circumstances, like the time they were in Omen together. But Hagg remains a loner, even when he's in the same place as Farmer and Ward, like he was at the time of the Carrancas fall in Spain. Ward and Farmer knew that meteorite hunters would be descending on the high plains of the Andes and that they had better book a flight quick to beat Hagg and the others. Carrancas was looking increasingly promising for being a valuable meteorite. Then there was the most fascinating aspect of the Carrancas meteorite. News reports were flooding in that said people in the area were getting sick, unheard of in meteorite landfalls. In the days following the crash, those who handled pieces of the meteorite began to fall ill and an influx of patients suddenly appeared at the local hospital. Rumors that the meteorite was contaminated, radioactive, or even cursed began to swirl. As with all witnessed meteorites, Karankas confused and frightened people as it shrieked across the sky. And in the aftermath, locals began to speculate on what it was that they saw. Charges of UFOs, a falling scorpion, or even an alleged mythical creature that flies between mountaintops were all claimed to have been seen. And now nausea, vomiting, and headaches were being experienced by dozens of people, even including police and a health director who had visited the site of the crater. Claims of mysterious illness were coming from all over and garnering further international attention. People began believing the meteorite was a bad sign of things to come. The exact opposite interpretation of the Encisai meteorite when it was determined to be a sign of the Holy Roman Empire's victory over the French. These are examples of how our brains cannot help themselves from attempting to ascribe meaning and purpose to random events. Epic Magazine reports that the odds that a meteorite landing at that spot in Karankas was 1 in 182 trillion. Astronomical odds for an astronomical event. On some primitive and less mathematical level, our brains register this unlikelihood in their own way and make a determination aligned with such odds, either believing it to be a divine, miraculous message, such as Maximilian did with Encisheim, or terrible omens, like the people of the High Andes did with Karankas. Meteorites have been blamed for the fall of Jerusalem in 66 CE, the Vesuvius eruption in 79 CE, and the London Plague of 1665. In their own way, the people of Karankas were trying to determine how this meteorite fit into their psychological matrix, just as humanity always did when witnessing seemingly impossible events. In Karankas, the local mayor was confronted with superstitions and fear of what pieces remained of the meteorite from the impact could do. This was the fragile psychological state of the community that Mike Farmer and Robert Ward stepped into when they reached the Peruvian High Plains to inspect the crater for themselves. When they reached the impact site, they were confronted with a 20-foot deep hole of water. Ward and Farmer had to quickly think of a plan to retrieve the only known chondrite to have left an impact crater before it dissolved. The scientific value alone of the Karankas main mass was immeasurable. They knew that somewhere in the murky depths of muddy water was a chondrite that had defied the known laws of physics. The pieces of the meteorite that broke off on its descent were all around, and Ward and Farmer confirmed firsthand that it was indeed a chondrite. They knew they had to get it out of the watery pit soon. But Ward and Farmer were also aware of their foreign status among the locals that weren't comfortable with foreigners suddenly showing up. They were strangers in a far-off land, and the locals did not trust the meteorite they were seeking to raise from the pit. Farmer and Ward realized that the only way they were going to retrieve this scientifically important artifact was to convince the local community to trust both them and the idea that taking the meteorite from the ground was good. What made things worse for Farmer and Ward was that Hag had already beat them to the small town and had gotten a hold of a portable PA system in which he used to drive around the town to announce that he had money for anyone who could bring him pieces of the meteorite. For most people, taking either Hag's approach of driving around town in a foreign country announcing that you're full of cash, or the Farmer and Ward approach, where they attempt to get a superstitious community to help them retrieve the main mass out of a deep and muddy hole, would be madness. Hag could have been easily targeted by local criminals, and Farmer and Ward were looking at a pit of muddy water where it was totally possible that no rock would be found at all, having disintegrated between the crash and the water. Ward and Farmer agreed to push forward anyway. Ward was already not happy with the amount of people who were involving themselves in the recovery, and Farmer was realizing that cultural and religious beliefs were likely going to be an additional impediment. Farmer, the only one who could speak Spanish, had to then convince the locals that not only the chondrite was not poisonous, but that it was not spiritually harmful to lift the rock either. Slowly, Farmer's pleas began to work, and people began seeing opportunities from raising the rock. The mayor even thought a museum could be built around the meteorite to be a tourist attraction. But there were conditions. Only the locals should be allowed to be cut in on the deal, not the police or authorities from the nearby regional capital of Puno, over 200 miles away. Farmer and Ward were good with this, but there was more. Even after the locals voted and agreed to lift the rock, the local shaman needed to sacrifice a llama fetus to the spirits to see if they agreed with their decision. Farmer and Ward waited as patiently as possible while the shaman read the signs of the offering. It was good news. The shaman said that they were allowed to pump the water and lift the rock. With the help of a large pump brought in from another town, a parade of locals made their way to the impact site to watch the lifting of the rock. But as the water began to drain, more people began to show up, including additional police officers and local politicians, all making their way to the draining crater. One politician was even equipped with a loudspeaker, and things slowly began to get out of hand. Between the pump, the loudspeaker, shouting, paperwork, and gesturing, the scene was becoming chaotic, and soon someone shut off the pump, and slowly the water began to refill. There was a dispute over who actually had rights to the rock that fell from the sky, something that most places have no formal laws on, something that can be either beneficial or restrictive to meteorite hunters like Farmer and Ward. Finally, the police stepped in and decided that no one could be allowed in the area, which ignited a further uproar. But Ward saw how close the pit was to being empty and could not help but to go over and turn the pump back on, even as Farmer warned him that it would lead to trouble. But they were just so close, and Ward decided the chance was worth it. And suddenly, all of the anger that had built up over who had rights to the meteorite turned instantly on the suspicious foreigners, and Farmer and Ward knew that they had to go before they were arrested. As Epic Magazine put it, quote, "The rock had gone from spiritual totem to apple of discord. No one was afraid of the rock anymore. Everyone wanted it for themselves, if it was even still there. As the crowd argued, the crater slowly refilled with water." End quote. But law enforcement was not going to let Ward and Farmer go that easily. When they returned to the town where they were staying, the police took them down to the station and confiscated their passports, interrogating them and accusing them of operating in Peru without authorization. It was foreshadowing the danger of what Ward and Farmer would experience in Omen 4 years later, and again for Farmer in Kenya. At the police station in Peru, accusations such as, "You don't know what you've done, you stirred up the people," and "What right do you have? This is not your country," were lobbed at Farmer and Ward before their passports were returned, with a warning that they were being watched. Whether it was rock or person, foreign intruders were not welcome. An attempt to get the world's only known landed chondrite had quickly turned into a desperate escape plan. The nearby border crossing into Bolivia was closed for the night, so they packed and prepared to skip town and out of the country the following day. But at 4 a.m., two officers came to their door and woke Farmer up and demanded $2,000. When Farmer refused, they ominously insinuated that soon they would have all of their money. At dawn the next morning, they faced a line of police protecting the border, looking out for Farmer and Ward. They inconspicuously found a cab driver, quickly threw their items into the trunk, and took off out of town toward another border crossing 50 miles to the north at Lake Titicaca. As they drove off, police were scrambling to give chase, but none were able to catch up to the cab. Ultimately, they reached their destination, crossed the lake, and reached Bolivia safely. As they checked their emails, they found that even the U.S. Embassy in Lima had been trying to reach them, hearing that they had been arrested for trying to steal the meteorite. They assured the embassy that they were safe and had nothing more than a few fragments of the Carancas meteorite. Farmer ultimately donated many of his fragments to scientific institutions. The story of the Carrancas meteorite brings forth the question of who would sanely take on the position of a meteorite hunter, knowing that this is the risk that is associated with every landfall. Not only are there language and cultural barriers, but great financial and physical risks as well. By the time Aguas Zarcas had hit in 2019, Farmer and Ward were old hats at international meteorite hunting and knew full well the danger they were in for with each and every trip. But with these details, it's clear that more than just profit drive the motives of these intrepid hunters, and it's understandable why they would expect compensation for their efforts. But two mysteries remained surrounding the Carrancas landfall. How did a chondrite create an impact crater, and what about it got everyone sick? These are the questions that most intrigued scientists after the event. Stories of spy satellites, mud volcanoes, and arsenic in the water were being published across the planet as speculation ran wild with whether the impact was even a meteorite at all. But Farmer knew it was a meteorite, as he told the Brown Daily Herald that, quote, "the entire ground was white, just white powder, which was all meteor," end quote. The blast had knocked people over, just like it had in Chelyabinsk. Nothing short of a bomb could have been the only alternative. Farmer is not one to mistake a meteorite when he sees one, although he admits he has at least one occasion where he paid $10,000 for a plain terrestrial rock. But there was no mistaking the smoking gun at Carrancas. Farmer was able to easily confirm that it was a chondrite, but how did a chondrite impact Earth when, by all rights, it should have broken apart in the air? Maybe Carrancas came in very slowly, shallow, and easily, allowing the meteorite to stay intact. The glass mineral grains found from shock deformations proved otherwise. This meteorite was traveling at too high of speeds. The latest theory is that the chondrite would have been able to stay mostly together even as it was breaking apart, if the shape of the chondrite began to elongate. This would have made the meteorite pieces more aerodynamic and preserving the meteorite as a closely collected mass to the main body. If this were the case, then the chondrite would not have had to necessarily be together as one whole piece, but instead as many fractured pieces clumped close together on their burning descent down to Earth. This may be why, when Ward and Farmer tried to drain the impact crater, it was difficult to find a main mass, as by that point it would have been totally obliterated, perhaps even the reason for the white powder everywhere. So then, what about the sudden illnesses directly after the crash? Out of all of the crazy theories, the one that had the most credibility was about arsenic deposits in the earth that were released with the impact of the meteorite. But even this theory was mostly dismissed by scientists who say that arsenic in such high quantities were unlikely to have been disturbed as to make that many people sick. The Karankas chondrite was analyzed and understood to not be made up of any unusual or dangerous type of stone either. Instead, one of the scientists studying the impact called the mysterious illness a psychological response, stating that the headaches and nausea could have come from the disorienting crash of the meteorite. With what Farmer and Ward witnessed regarding the local beliefs of mythical creatures, spirits, and sacrifices, it isn't that much of a stretch to think that the shock alone of the meteorite crash on this small, isolated community could have somaticized their fear. Hysteria, fear, hope, omens, prophecies, these are the likely, natural, human responses to the sight of a giant burning rock plummeting from the heavens on any ancient culture. Would it be a surprise that a traditional region such as Karankas would behave any differently? The sound of the meteor coming to Earth would have included a disorienting, explosive burst. Anyone within close range to its landing site would have been knocked over. So it's no wonder people might become dizzy, sick, and headachy. That the fright of a meteor landing sent hundreds of people to the hospital in some ways shows the power that these bolts from the blue can have on us. And Ward and Farmer could attest that the worries of the illness did not bother anyone when there was potential money to be made from the impact. It may seem like an open and shut case of overreaction, but there are multiple witnesses that claim that the meteor came with a smell as it crashed towards Earth, something not typically associated with iron or chondrite meteorites. Although carbonaceous chondrite meteorites can carry a smell from their organic materials, but Karankas was not carbonaceous, which means there wasn't a smell, the smell was mistaken, or something is still left unaccounted for. Until something new is understood about the Karankas crash, it seems like mass hysteria is the best explanation for all of the mysterious illnesses surrounding its fall. Thank you for listening to this episode of No Character Limit. Every episode, the sources that I used are located in the description if you would like to check them out. In addition, please consider liking, rating, and reviewing if you enjoyed this podcast, as each one goes to help further the reach of this podcast for new people to hear. Each episode requires hours in research, writing, recording, and editing. So If you feel that what you just heard is worth a donation of any size, please go to the description and follow the links for that. Each donation comes with a free PDF copy of a writing piece of your choice, no matter the size of your donation, and you get a lot of extra features with that, including a lot of the artwork and graphs and pictures, as well as the descriptions that I don't include in the podcast. If you would like updates for new episodes, you can follow No Character Limit at mastodon.world. And finally, if you have a question, comment, or even a correction, please feel free to reach out at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again for listening.